Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. The Death Star has imploded. So joining me in this edition of the Bulwark Podcast, Tim Miller, who I think this is your 19th, your 20th appearance on the Bulwark. So I think you get a mug or something now, Tim.
I'm waiting for that commemorative pin, Charlie. I'm just okay, I'll be waiting for that in the mail here in Oakland.
Or maybe just an emoji. Oh, so you must be the coastal elite that I'm constantly hearing about all the time. I'm sitting here in Wisconsin, but I'm reading a critique of the Bulwark that we are the coastal elite or something. That's you. At least
I am the coastal elite, and I'm living in a place that's like living in hell, according to the president a couple of weeks ago. Oakland, Chicago, Baltimore. It's like living in hell here. You don't even know. It's 75 every day. There's some minor graffiti on the street. It's pretty tough life.
Well, I suppose Mequon is coastal if you count the Great Lakes.
That's true.
If you count the coast of the
you're on Great a coast. Lakes.
We will get to that in just a little while.
Just really quick, briefly speaking about our elite status, we are both 10 out of 10 Room Raider people. All listeners are in the presence of two.
You got a 10 out of 10?
I did. Well, my new one. I put the steer. I changed. I got a 7 out of 10, so I changed locations. Nobody says I'm not responsive to feedback, so you can DM me if you have feedback on my performance today. And I moved to, I have a steer skull. I put that in the backdrop, and that was met with positive reviews, apparently.
Okay, so for people who don't know what we're talking about, if you do a Skype appearance on cable television, there's a website that rates your room with the background, and it's of course a very, very big deal for all of us who crave this kind of feedback. I got a 10 out of 10 yesterday because I think I put a little picture of my older dog Pete. He made a cameo appearance, and it was very, very popular. So, hey, so congratulations.
Thank you. You too. Congratulations.
We're in a kind of a rarefied world. but I also, speaking of cable television appearance, I need to explain my Pornhub reference, because it just sort of popped out that they were talking about this, the St. Louis couple, and I said it was almost like an episode from Trump World Pornhub, and a lot of eyebrows went up about this. So
my eyebrow is going up right now.
I'm going to back into this a little bit. So yesterday was arguably the worst polling day of the Trump presidency. I mean, it starts off with the CNBC poll showing that Biden's maintaining his lead in all the crucial swing states. He's up 51-45 in Arizona, 50-43 in Florida, 48-42 in Michigan. He's up by 1 point in North Carolina, blowing out in Pennsylvania, 50-42. Wisconsin, Biden 48, Trump 42. Okay, so that starts the day. Then you get this Monmouth poll out of Pennsylvania showing Trump down there. This is state he won, but showing him down there by 13 points. And then before you absorb that, you got this devastating Quinnipiac poll showing Biden leading Trump by 15 percentage points. And there's
that's a
polling
lot.
Analyst. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a lot.
Tim, I'm a polling analyst as well, and that's a big lead.
There's no upside, no silver lining, no encouraging trend hidden somewhere in this survey for the president. Independents now backing Biden 51-34. Wrong track, right track numbers are absolutely horrific. And then, because the day hadn't been complete, NBC Wall Street Journal poll comes out showing Biden up by 11, 51-40. The trend lines are all in the same place. Of course, by the end of the day, while Twitter was, were you in Twitter quarantine, by the way, when they blocked all the blue checks?
Brief Twitter quarantine. I did survive. Yeah.
The president of the United States was apparently quarantined because he had to go to Facebook to fire Brad Parscale, his campaign. He couldn't wait for Twitter to come back. He had to fire him. But in any case, I'm working back to the Pornhub reference. Okay. So
I'm waiting anxiously for this. This is a big windup.
How does Trump World react to these absolutely horrible numbers? Well, what they do is they go into their fantasy world. Here's Steve Doocy on Fox and Friends.
Because when you look at the polls and you say, okay, look, Joe Biden is way ahead, and, you know, that's across the board. But then you think about, well, how many secret voters are there? And it looks as if back in 2016, there were those as well. The data that we release is only as good as the poll. And if somebody picks up the phone and they say, hey, I want to ask you about Donald Trump, and they just go, you know what, I'm not interested in talking about that right now, and that is a so-called secret voter, then the data does not really reflect what is going on across the country.
I mean,
and this morning there are stories about how there's been a they're rearranging the positions at the Trump campaign because of the president's polling, and that Brad Parscale has been assigned to digital, and Bill Stefian is now going to take over as campaign manager. You know, that's the story that's out there. But the question is, how reliable are the polls, Jedediah, given the fact that there are these secret voters? And we know there are from 20.
They're secret voters.
Did he say secret voters or secret voters? Are you sure he's not talking about the voters?
We're going to get back to the voters, too. Okay, so it gets better because, of course, this Monmouth poll shows Trump losing Pennsylvania by 13 points, which is pretty much that's kind of the dagger. MSNBC reached out to Hugh Hewitt for his analysis, and here's Hugh's fantasy world.
And I'll tell you, Steve, I grew up 7 miles from Pennsylvania. I don't believe that number today. I talk weekly with Selena Zito on my radio show. Western Pennsylvania is deep red. And Joe Biden and whoever is running it is, whether it's Val Demings or Kamala Harris or whoever it is, they are going to be anti-energy and anti the thing that has brought Pennsylvania back. So I think Pennsylvania is the keystone of those three states. I think Western Pennsylvania is the keystone of the keystone. And I, God forbid, it's down to the Steelers fans, but that's what it looks like to me.
All right, Hugh Hewitt.
I think it's Philadelphia.
We got a little Western Pennsylvania. Philadelphia. Yep, we got that rivalry going here, it sounds like. But we'll have to leave it there for now. Hugh.
Yeah, who needs polls, Tim, when you can talk to Selena Zito every week?
God bless whoever was laughing in the background of Hughes. I don't know, was that the other guest on the show, or was that your wife when you were taping it?
That was me.
That was really good.
I wasn't on with him, no.
Here's the thing, you know, with these guys is they, you know, if you're Hugh, if you're Fox and Friends, it's fan service all the way down, right? Yeah. At this point. And so, you know, the benefit that they have that Trump doesn't, unfortunately, or fortunately for us, have is that, you know, because of this 2016, you know, PTSD that everybody has, they can do this all the way till November. I mean, Biden could be up for 15 all the way till November, and they can do this shtick about how it's fake because it, you know, as far as in the minds of their audience, it did turn out to be fake last time, right? And I do think that that is what they're going to be do because they have no incentive otherwise. The interesting thing, though, I think, as it impacts politics, is that Trump also believes, I think, this BS. Sure. And so when all the experts were telling him he was going to lose last time, and now the same experts are saying to him, you know, Mr. President, maybe you should, I don't know, take the virus a little more seriously. The polls aren't looking good. You know, I think that he is, his compulsion on this from 2016, it comes in and he says, why would I listen to these guys? They were all wrong last time. They told me I was going to lose after the pussy tape.
Well, and they're also creating this this Potemkin Village campaign where they're spending huge amounts of money aimed at, you know, in the media markets where Donald Trump will see it on television to make him think that everything is going well. Okay, so here's this fantasy world that they've created, this fantasy world. And as you know, in Trump world, in order to really get through, you have to create these images. And in my newsletter, I had, you know, some of the pictures of, you know, Trump porn world, you know, Trump on the tank holding the, you know, AK-47, Trump as Rambo, Trump as bodybuilder, you know, you get my, it's not real life. I mean, they have this sort of, you know, fetish about, you have to think of how strong and what a winner he is, and what a rocking heart and hot body he has, if you really close your eyes hard enough. You know, he has these fantasies out there. You know that he's got these fetishes. You know, he wants to, you know, he's fascinated with the notion of soldiers with fixed bayonets on American cities, which gets me, I'm getting to this Pornhub reference. So we're talking about this couple in St. Louis who were brandishing the guns, and he's fixated on this. When he keeps talking about them, he's called the governor of Missouri and said, I'm going to get involved in all of this. And this is like a scene. I thought this was like a scene of Trump World Pornhub. You know, these white suburban, like, you know, Brooks Brother wearing couple. They were actually not
Joey.
I know that, but you know, waving guns at black protesters. I mean, this is their fantasy. I mean, isn't that really? This is the fantasy of the kind of voter that Trump imagines is going to come out at the end and reelect him. I mean, all you need to do is put them in a boat with a Trump flag, and you have this perfect fantasy of how he's going to turn this election around. Now, the rest of us think it's absolutely ridiculous, but they've created this alternative fantasy, and you have to, ooh, this is good. Just click here, and it's like you're going to see this image and this image. But I just think another indication of how these folks have lost touch with reality. They have lost the script. And I do think that the fact that they are so invested in this delusion, that this has really become a problem for Republicans, because if the base that is listening to talk radio and listening to Fox News thinks that everything is great, then they're not going to see what's coming.
Well, I'm going to let your familiarity with the porn website URL slide, Charlie. We're not going to get into that.
And, I've heard of it. I've read of it.
Right. I think you're right, and it ties into the. Well, I remember you talking with Tom Nichols about this. It ties into the younger wife, you know, having a model wife with Melania. That's part of this image. I saw I don't know if you saw this, the Dilbert guy, the big Trump guy, also, you know, married a very inappropriately young woman. This past weekend, and all the Trumpers are, you know, sharing pictures of this, like, really nerdy, awkward Trump fan with his hot wife as, you know, kind of a proof of the strength. And I think that the St. Louis story is absolutely right on that. It is a fantasy. It is like that this old fat Trump guy can menace the young black protesters, and that is some sort of metaphor for what's going to happen in the election.
I've been worried, and I think I've been vocally worried about whether or not he would get some traction with the law and order issue and trying to turn this into violence and I alone can protect you.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the numbers that came out yesterday, and there is no evidence anywhere that this is in fact working for him. And you know, this is his playbook. This is what he's got. His instincts tell him he's going to play this. He goes on, was it ABC or CBS the other day, and he was asked about police killing, you know, black men. And he's going, no, they kill more white men than white people. White people are dying too. I don't know how many times he said white, but he honestly deeply believes that this is the path to victory, and it's not connected as far as I can tell at all.
Yeah, he said the quote that really struck out with me with regard to this St. Louis family is that these protesters were going to ransack and burn down their home. He said this yesterday in the press conference, and it reminded me of the caravan, you know, in the end of the 2018 election that didn't work.
The Mexican rapists.
Yeah. But it's like, this is not landing with people right now. I mean, there are a lot of things that people are concerned about, but the protesters, you know, ransacking their you know, rich people's homes and raping their wives, like that's not reality for anybody. And so I do think that he's kind of lost the thread on this. And I was surprised. I know that I forget if Sarah Longwell was on here talking about her article, but you know, she said this in her article about focus groups with women. And it also struck me was that is how many of them blame Trump for the violence.
Right.
You know, they think that he is the instigator and he is the match on this, and they're not, you know, blaming the looters. Yeah. He's not the protector. He's the arsonist. You know, that might not be what a small percentage of his base thinks, but I think that there's a big segment of the electorate that feels that way. And so that's why it's not working for him.
And this is really why 2020 is so different from 2016. You know, in 2016, he really was the match of the man in the moment, right? I mean, and this is what he sells. He sells anger and chaos. But in 2020, I think people want empathy and competence. So if you're going to go back to sell this, the same old stuff from your playbook, anger and chaos, this is not what people want. This is not matching the man to the moment. And I'm not sure that he can do anything about it. There's nothing that Donald Trump can do at this point to say, no, really, I do care. I am empathetic. I have normal human emotions. And in fact, I am, you know, competently able to do all of this. That's passed. Which brings me to the fascinating piece, and I'm not just pulling your chain here, in the Bulwark today that you have, the myth of Trump as a centrist deal maker. And I think I told you before the podcast, there are moments when I think that everything that could possibly be said about Donald Trump has been said. And I think you have hit on something that I think a lot of people don't fully understand, which was the degree to which in 2016 that a lot of people bought the idea that Trump was not this bomb thrower extremist that we saw, or, you know, narcissistic chronic liar. They really did see him as the guy that could go in the room and cut deals and get things done. And I do think that a lot of the media elites don't appreciate how salient that was for a portion of the electorate. You know, I mean, I remember people calling my talk show back in the day and in a different life saying, well, no, he's a businessman. You know, he will get things right. done. He will make Republicans and Democrats sit in the room, and he will, you know, make them come to some sort of a compromise and deal. And of course, that's gone now. He can't go back to that. So tell me about your piece.
And he has seemed to lose as well. You know, it was something that Trump, the candidate, understood in 15 and 16. Now, obviously, he had all of his personal foibles still at the time, and you know, he went over the top on a lot of things. No doubt, I don't want to minimize that. But instinctually, he understood that Ted Cruz, in particular in the primary, was seen as a kind of severe, extreme, hardline, almost weird to a weird degree candidate, and that he could contrast with that as somebody who, you know, made deals. And so I opened the article with this quote from, I think he was doing Fox News Sunday, late in the primary. And he said, look at the way Ted's dealt with the Senate, where he goes in there, frankly, like a little bit of a maniac. You can't walk into the Senate and scream and call people liars and not be able to cajole and get along with people. He'll never get anything done. And that's the problem with Ted. I mean, he nailed it. That was the problem with Ted. And it's also the problem with Donald now. He's all those same things. And so he has lost his own thread on that. And while a lot of us, like you said, never really bought that. Like, I never, you know, and to me, it never occurred to me that maybe Donald and Chuck and Nancy would be sitting down and cutting deals with one another. I never believed that would work, but he thought that was a good brand, and voters bought that brand. Not all of them, but some of them. And so because of that deal-making ability, and because of his heterodox views on a couple of issues, in particular the Iraq War and entitlement spending, for those three reasons, generally, not everybody, but there was a big segment of the electorate that saw him as kind of a non-political centrist deal making guy, in contrast to Cruz and Hillary, who they saw more as extreme ideological.
He did well among moderate Republican voters, moderate and liberal Republican voters there for a while during the primaries, which I had forgotten, which I found it as a complete mystery to me at the time. But I think you put your finger on it. They did see him as someone who could move the ball forward, solve problems, work across the aisle.
Yeah, my PTSD from working against him in that primary is, I think, what drove this article, because I remember being just frustrated and angry by that when I was working on that anti-Trump super PAC, and we were coming up on these states like New York, Connecticut, you know, New Jersey, that had a lot of moderate voters, and Trump ran away with it. And so I went back and looked at the exit polls, and, you know, I looked at Florida as just a telling example because Marco was still in the race. So I think if you asked conventional wisdom among DC political types, they'd say that Marco appealed more to the center because he wasn't quite as extreme on immigration and race stuff, and, you know, it's whatever. But that wasn't true among voters. Trump crushed Marco in his home state among moderate voters by 20 points. Crushed him. And so, you know, these these non-ideological, a lot of these voters are maybe not moderate in the way that like you and I think of moderate. Right. They're not like fiscally conservative and pro-gay marriage, you know, pro-choice. They're more like kind of non-religious, you know, maybe don't care that much about Paul Ryan spending and deficit stuff. Don't care that much about, you know, the strong military, but do care about cultural issues. Like these sorts of moderate centrist voters, really Trump appealed to them. And so and the problem is that he's totally lost that thread this time. And if you look at data now, it's Biden that is seen as being in the center, and Trump is seen out on the edges of the party, and it's of his own doing.
I just want to keep underlining this point because I think a lot of people do miss this. And what you wrote was that back in 2016, a lot of voters were looking for a politician who said he would get a bunch of people in the room, butter them up, get a great deal for the American people. They wanted a businessman who was going to be able to solve the problems and help them make money. Where has that guy been? We have not seen him since the campaign. Trump trashed the whole persona the second he gave the dark and weird and poorly attended inauguration speech, jammed conservatism Inc.'s agenda down the Democrats' throats, and made racist attacks on their congressional delegation. So, yeah, the president right now, who is, you know, talking about the caravans from Guatemala or is, you know, stoking up white grievance, is not at all the guy that in 2016 was saying, I'm the one who's going to get you the big infrastructure bill. I'm the one who's going to get things done. I'm the one who's going to override partisan gridlock. It's a completely different persona in 2020 than 2016. And I think we lose that because we, you know, and again, because I never had any illusions about him, that we didn't realize you had tens of millions of people who had spent years watching him on The Apprentice and had that vision of him, not the Steve Bannon 2016, you know, persona that was created.
And Trump as a business guy also might not have just understood some of the political realities of this. I mean, I think in his old life, he could trash people and then come to the table to cut a deal with them because it was all about money. Right. But, you know, then in the new life, you can't go make racist attacks on Elijah Cummings one day and then the next day go to, you know, Nancy and say, hey, I want to cut a deal with you. Right. I mean, this stuff lingers. And so, you know, you could imagine an alternate universe of deal making Trump, where right now during the virus, you know, he's pulling out the whole old West Wing thing and he walks down Pennsylvania Avenue and like, let's get in a room and let's cut the best deal. Let's cut a great deal. This was the image a lot of voters had of him. And so instead of doing that, what is he doing now? Like he's, you know, talking about the Joe Scarborough cold case. And, you know, like we said, talking about like these people in St. Louis's house getting ransacked. And so, you know, there's this disconnect. And so I was watching a focus group just yesterday of former Trump voters who are souring on him. And every person in there said that. Like
they did.
Like pretty much it went around the circle and pretty much every person said something to the effect of, like, I need, you know, my job. I have issues with my job right now. I need my, you know, unemployment insurance is about to run out. Like stuff is, you know, there's real shit happening here in my community. And this guy was, you know, when I bought it, he was going to be a deal maker. He was a business guy. He was going to help us make money. And so, you know, not all of those people have totally soured on him. You know, he still has this cult like impact on some people. And some of the folks in the focus group said, I still think he can do it. Between now and November, I still think that this could be part of the plan, but others, you know, had given up and said, you know, look, I expected something different than what I got. And I do think that is, you know, for probably most of our listeners, weird because, you know, as soon as the Muslim ban happened or as soon as rapists and murderers happened, you know, I was pretty sour on the prospect of Donald Trump as a deal maker. but that wasn't the case for voters. And he understood that in a way that I think he's lost.
Yeah. And now he's painted himself into a corner because he can't go back to that. So, you know, you raised a point, and I heard A.B. Stoddard making this point yesterday as well, that you can very easily imagine an alternative reality in which Donald Trump is cruising easily to reelection, maybe even landslide reelection. Had he been a deal maker, if he'd sat down, right out of the box with the Democrats and crafted a huge infrastructure bill, as opposed to his approach. If he had taken the pandemic seriously and said, okay, let's get this thing, you know, I'm going to show my competence. I'm going to show my savvy. We're going to do whatever it takes to stop all of this. And people would say, here's a guy that protected us. Here's a guy that did these things. He's advanced the ball. He's changed the calculus of American politics.
Look at Cuomo, for example. I mean, Cuomo didn't even do a good job, but he did a terrible job. Yeah, he just faked it. You know, he did what Trump could have done, right? Played this part of, you know, I'm the problem solver, I'm the convener, you know, I'm going to give you tough talk. I mean, Trump isn't that, you know, Trump is not as skilled as Cuomo, right? And you know, he has all of his own issues, but it's not so hard to imagine Trump playing that role or trying to play that role. And he didn't even try.
It's an interesting contrast. He's not capable of showing the kind of empathy that Andrew Cuomo made, right. But it is worth pointing out, though, that Andrew Cuomo, at some point, there's going to have to be a reevaluation of Cuomo's performance because it was terrible. Pretty awful. I mean, it was pretty
terrible. It was bizarre, actually. People have memory hold this. Into early March, Cuomo was like in a fight with de Blasio over not shutting things down.
Yeah.
Things were spiraling out of control. I mean, they were literally Trump and de Blasio and Cuomo were probably the three worst like politicians in the entire country. I think that Cuomo, I guess, recognized that, but I mean, too late.
No, and in fact, yesterday I was putting together after Jake Tapper broke bad on him for spiking the football. I went down, went back and looked at some of the stuff, and you know, it wasn't until March 20th, after California had shut down, that Andrew Cuomo finally got around to shutting down. And in fact, in late March,
things were
March
way worse in New York than California by March 20th. Yeah, by the way,
right? Exactly. This is what he said on March 17th. Okay. He said, I'm as afraid of the fear and the panic as I am of the virus. And I think that the fear is more contagious than the virus right now.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's just. And this is when he's arguing about arguing with de Blasio. So, yeah, there's a contrast. OK, so let's talk about the Death Star, because we have to.
Would love
this.
to do that.
Brad Parscale. Is unceremoniously fired on Facebook, which is interesting that even though he kept the significant others of members of the Trump family, girlfriends, wives, and stuff on the payroll, that wasn't enough to protect his grift. The Tulsa thing was a disaster. I think one of the sweetest parts of the story was the Wall Street Journal report that Trump had seen an ad from the Project Lincoln folks pointing out what a grifter Brad was, how he was buying himself fancy cars, living in a fancy house. And apparently that pissed off the president. So once again, George Conway, Rick Wilson and company, they had their, you know, audience of one in mind and scored.
Yeah, kudos to those guys, my pal John Weaver, and to JVL, to credit to JVL as well, who was very early on the Brad has no chance to survive camp. Mm-hmm. I get a 50-50 on this one because I thought that he was going to survive for the reason that there are some pretty hot rumors that he's financially tied in with the Trump kids, and that there's a grift going on here with these ads, and that everybody's taking a cut. And so I didn't think he was going to get fired for that reason. Turns out he gets demoted, but still keeps control over the digital operation, which lets that grift keep rolling. So I'll give myself 50-50 while JVL and the Lincoln Project get 100% score on that prediction. There's some Schadenfreude here, which I appreciate, of course. I think the most interesting part of this, in addition to that Trump is just such an easy mark that he would be susceptible to this ad, the other interesting thing is that he replaces him with Bill Stepien, who was the operative that that shut down the bridge in New Jersey. And he was in the way, and he was, I don't know if mastermind is probably overstating it, but he was the strategist who wanted to punish the mayor of Fort Lee, shut down the bridge, and
but he was never criminally charged.
No, but in his in the email, because he didn't have he wasn't the final decision maker there. He needed to get I'm blanking on the other guy's name to approve it. But he got fired by Christie despite being close friends because his emails about Bridgegate were so callous, right? And how he was talking about this. And so it's like
his name came up 700 times during the trial.
Yeah, it's like it's perfect. It is just so perfect that Trump, who replaced his first campaign manager in 2016 with a Russian asset and a Russian operative in Paul Manafort, in 2020 replaces his campaign manager with the guy that it was implicated in the Bridgegate scandal. I mean, you can't draw it up from the quote unquote drain the swamp candidate.
Well, there's a couple of points that have to be made here. I'm not carrying any water for Brad Parscale. How do you pronounce Parscale?
Yeah.
I'm not carrying any water for him at all because I think he's an overpromoted troll. He'd never run anything like this. He was clearly in way over his head. But I think it's important to note that the president is not 15 points behind in the polls because of Brad Parscale. Right. He's not the one who screwed the pooch on the pandemic. He's not the one who staged these stupid photo ops, with the tear gas and the Bibles. He's not the one who ignored the Russian bounties on American soldiers. He's not the one, playing the race card or delivers those incoherent rants in the Rose Garden. So that's not his fault. And also, so Bill Stepien's coming in, but let's be honest about it. This is still going to be the Donald Trump, Jared Kushner show. So what the freak could go wrong?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that about Parscale, by the way. I mean, he was brought on for his digital expertise, to the extent that you want to call it expertise. I think his experience before the 2016 campaign was doing the websites for the Trump golf courses. But, to his credit, I guess he learned and he was adaptable. And Trump's digital operation is doing fine. I mean, if you look at the numbers, he's outperforming Biden on Facebook, and they're executing the plan they put forth. So it's not the campaign man. I mean, obviously he screwed the pooch in Tulsa, and he's obviously enriching himself, which is a big no-no. From a strategic standpoint, I totally agree with you. I mean, the campaign manager has nothing to do with this. Donald Trump is the problem. I also. Speaking of the Conways, do enjoy the fact that Kellyanne still has not, been the victorious campaign manager of 2016, quote unquote, is not brought back in. It's unclear exactly what she's doing, hanging out around there. I think she's just like leaking background things to Maggie Haberman all the time. It's unclear exactly what her job is at this point in the administration.
Well, you've been at the center of this, so you know what I'm talking about when I say that it feels like in the last 2 weeks, the impact of the never Trump organizations, like, for example, the Lincoln Project and Republican Voters Against Trump, which you're affiliated with and we share DNA with, although we're not directly connected, is having an impact, or because and you can measure that by the viciousness of the attacks against these organizations, the fact that you have columns and articles and even ads targeting the Lincoln Project. Republican Voters Against Trump have not really come quite into the crosshairs as much, but that really is an indication that they've shaken up this campaign in a pretty dramatic way.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason we haven't is because we're kind of elevating these real people. And, most of this is inside baseball BS, and the Trump, Trumpers are mad at George Conway, and so because of his wife, and so they're attacking him because of that. But, you still see the attacks on, we had the young man that was the head of the South Carolina College Republicans who came, who did a video for Republican Voters Against Trump about how he wasn't supporting Trump, who came under really harsh, over the top attacks. You know, like you said, there have been this series of columns. I think the reality is that we are striking a nerve, because there is this percentage of the former Trump voter that's moving. And it ties to the article that I wrote today, and it ties to these Never Trump groups, and obviously what's happening here at the Bulwark, is that, you know, people don't appreciate the fact that, you know, let's say that 4% of the party was Never Trumpers, right? And then let's say that another 12% were people that didn't really like Donald Trump ever. And they liked, the thing was, they just hated Hillary more. You know, they're the real life version of the anti-Trumpers. But since they don't have any financial incentive, they didn't get, you know, sucked into Trump Inc. So out in the country, there are people that didn't like Trump, didn't like Hillary. And, you know, for the most part, they'd stuck with him because the economy was good and the libs were crazy. And over the last 3 months, in concert with Arvat and in concert with the Lincoln Project starting, you know, Trump's popularity with these voters is sinking. And it's part due to the work we're doing. It's part due to Trump screwing himself. And so this is all congealing at the same time. And the thing is, while, you know, an additional 8% of the Republican base isn't enough to say beat Donald Trump in a primary, it's a massive difference in a general election. You know, and so if Trump goes from, say, you know, 95 to 86, with Republican voters, that's the difference between winning closely, like he did against Hillary, and losing a 400 electoral vote, you know, Mondale Reagan-esque landslide. So, you know, it just, a lot of times it's just, you have to look at, you know, these numbers and this community in a different way. And in this way, like these sort of softer Never Trumpers, the softer anti-Trumpers within the party are actually very, very important.
So what is it? How big is the group? 8%, 12%, 14%?
Yeah, I think that you can get the high watermark is about 20%. I think realistically, you're looking at like 12 to 15% of the party, like
that's
right
a
now.
Very big number.
That's a very, very big number.
In
yeah,
the general election. Yeah.
Yeah, and so right now, I think at his worst, you know, you're looking at potentially getting down to 85%. Now, some of this is malleable because some of these people don't identify as Republicans anymore. But yeah, I mean, look, again, if you're going from 4 to 12%, that's 8% of the Republican Party, which is about 8 million people in an election that he won last time by 80,000 votes. So, you know, this is 100% of his vote margin last time. And so it's a massively important group. And in concert with what, you know, our groups have been doing, you know, Trump has been screwing the pooch with these voters himself. And so you're seeing, and that is what is reflected in these poll numbers. So when you look at the 538, you know, and you see Trump's kind of even line, basically from 2016 all the way till now, starting to dip down, it's these voters that are going away from him.
You know, you've read the attacks on these organizations that by supporting Joe Biden or by, you know, encouraging people to vote against, particularly the Lincoln Project, targeting the Republican members of the Senate, that there's another word for Never Trumper. It's Democrat, that you have just simply become Democrats. What I think is interesting about the Republican voters against Trump is these videos. And for people who haven't seen them, they're very sort of what is the word I'm looking for? Because they're not slick. They're just people who've created their own videos.
They're raw. They're the opposite of slick. Raw. Yeah, they're selfie.
Exactly. Videos. They're raw. And each one of them makes the point that they voted for Trump. They are Republicans. They are conservatives. And then they make the case against Trump by drawing on conservative values. I think the most powerful one, I think maybe you agree with me on this one, was the spot of some evangelical Christians who just say, you know, this is offensive to me as a Christian. And that is targeted to really, I think, the most vulnerable part of the Trump constituency, people who might have voted for him because they thought it was a binary choice, who might have been hoping that he was going to be the deal maker or that he was going to grow or he was going to pivot, but now are saying, I'm willing to break ranks with this. They are clearly not liberals. They are clearly not Democrats, but they're clearly completely disillusioned with Donald Trump. that seems to be the formula.
Yeah, no doubt. So just to the first question really quick, I don't think that, you know, people like me and Stuart Stevens and, you know, who spent our entire career working for Republicans, this was part of a long con, and we've been secret Democrats and wolf's clothing the whole time. And so, you know, at some of these criticisms, these guys are just grasping at straws. But I do think one thing about what we're trying to do with RVAT that is complementary to Lincoln, that is a little bit different and trying to reach a different audience, is that these voters, a lot of the ones in these videos, like really still identify as Republican and conservative in a very deep way.
Right.
You know, and some of these voters might not share the view of a lot of some of our friends, Never Trump friends, who want to just, you know, say a pox on all their houses and just burn down the Senate and everybody who's been part of this should leave. Like a lot of these people might vote for Joe Biden and also vote for Tom Tillis, you know, in a swing state. And so, you know, our effort at Republican Voters Against Trump is to beat Donald Trump, right? And so that's the priority 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And so we want to get as many of those voters as possible. And so these ads are aimed at these people who have personal issues with Donald Trump. It might be religious, as you said. I really loved the ad on that. It might be, you know, military, you know, particularly with the Russian bounty stuff. It might just be competence and the fact that, like we said, they thought he was going to be able to solve problems, and he hasn't been. And so we're trying to reach those people, and what we found in research is they're more likely to listen to people like them who are also conflicted, who also still consider themselves conservative, who consider themselves Christians, rather than, you know, they might tune out these very harsh negative attacks on Trump because they see them as kind of attacks on them a little bit too. And that's been the strategy, and it's trying to reach a, you know, help expand that potential pool of voters for Biden.
See, I don't want to divide this into, you know, Bolsheviks versus Mensheviks, but there is a subtle distinction there that you've mentioned. The Lincoln Project has gone after the senators as well. All of the Republican senators, Republican Voters Against Trump, are focusing just on Trump. Just Trump.
Yeah, Trump only.
And Alpha and Omega.
Yeah, and as far as just, you know, Tim Miller speaking, I, you know, at this point, the senators can sink or swim. my level of care for them is zero. I just think that, yeah, as a strategic point, focusing just on Trump, it makes a lot of sense because it allows us to kind of reach a little bit of a different kind of demo and a kind of voter that might be turned off by attacks on senators. You know, I'm sure that there are some listeners of this podcast who still think, you know, I don't think that Cory Gardner is really the problem. I wish he would be tougher on Trump, but he's kind of in line with me politically on everything besides Trump. We want to reach those people with these ads and try to convince them to move over. And in addition to that, Charlie, the reason why it's called Republican Voters Against Trump and not Republicans for Biden is that we recognize that finding these Trump voters who maybe just can't ever get there to vote for a Democrat because being Republican is just such a part of their DNA, getting them to just sit it out or write in zombie Ronald Reagan or vote for the third party candidate, that helps Joe Biden just as much as getting somebody that voted for Evan McMullen last time to vote for Biden. Either one of those is a plus one for Biden, right? Somebody that goes Trump to Biden is obviously the best thing that we can do because that's a you know, that's plus two. But you know, this messaging allows us to try to reach these people who haven't maybe made this full flip. Whereas I think a lot of what the Lincoln Project is doing is really riding this wave from 2018, which is a lot of voters who are saying, you know, just totally screw everybody that's been associated with this. And at an emotional level, I appreciate that. But, I think that is a little bit of a different kind of voter. And that's another important voter to talk to. So in that way, I think they work together.
Well, and I think they're also engaging in psyops.
Oh, for sure.
Going after, you know, Donald Trump. And the story about the fact that Donald Trump saw their ad about Pascal, it was an indication of how that works. The fact that they got him obsessed about walking down the ramp. I mean, there's something going on with Trump. I don't know. I don't want to get into the psychology business, but that was some weird shit in the Rose Garden the other day. I mean, that was really, really bad. man. So you wonder what is going on inside.
Was it as weird or more weird as when he spent 20 minutes reenacting the ramp walk in Tulsa?
I know. Well, I mean, every day that he does this. Okay, so let's I want to do something else here. Okay. Because let me go back to where we started. Since you are the representative of the coastal elites here.
Yeah, sure, great.
As people know, there are people who don't really love the Bulwark. And believe it or not,
no way, Charlie.
We have our haters. We have people who are completely obsessed with this, but I have to tell you, and I think you know where I'm going on this. This is my all-time favorite critique by this brave, outspoken, completely anonymous critic at something called The Ricochet. Have you seen this thing?
Oh, I did see it in the Bulwark Slack. Yeah. You know, there's a little chatter about it.
Okay, this is so good. Listeners don't have to actually look this up, but this guy, I don't know who wrote it, because of course he was like, brave sir critic, whatever, came out and didn't want to put his name on it, but he has a whole paragraph about who we are based on the artwork in the Bulwark, which you and I are both think is fantastic. You know, Hannah Yost does just amazing work. She came over from the Weekly Standard, where she did much of the same thing. But I mean, she is really one of the things that I think sets the Bulwark apart from other publications is the fact the artwork just it is great. It's fantastic. And Hannah, okay, so here it goes. I'm just going to read this because this is so good. This is, again, something called The Ricochet. The Bulwark clearly is staffed by people who have been marinating in the full bore culture of the coastal left for too long. Even the graphics have that overprocessed graphic design school sheen to them that looks like something off early 2000 slate.com. As of this writing, there's a graphic of Trump with a crown. This is actually on my piece about his press conference, a graphic of Trump with a crown that is clearly inspired by the works of the 1980s neo-expressionist Jean-Michel Basquiat, an artist.
Pause really quick here just to say that I'm falling down on my coastal elite creds, and I think it's very amusing that this person identified that as a Jean-Michel Basquiat reference, and I had no idea who the hell that was until I Googled it.
Yeah, apparently you need to be a different kind of coastal elitist to know, okay, well, look at this. This is clearly based on the neo-expressionist Jean-Michel Basquiat. Oh, yes, who would not know that? An artist whose works were explicitly political in their examination of wealth, class, and colonialism. So somebody showing off a little bit there. This is not something that one would see in, say, the Weekly Standard. Of course it was, because it's the same art director, Henry Oates. But it is something the lefties who buy New York Magazine would lap up. It instantly transmits the message, hey, we're worldly coastal elites just like you. We go to the Whitney and the Guggenheim. We're down with Bob Iger and Margaret Atwood and Oprah Winfrey. We're one of you.
Yeah, I'm in such mixed view on this because I'm a proud coastal elite here in Oakland.
I'm in Mequon, Wisconsin.
I have no shame about this, but I've never been to the Whitney or the Guggenheim, I don't believe, and I don't really have any sort of emotional attachment to Bob Iger. and I hated The Handmaid's Tale. So, I don't know, maybe there's something. I'm sure we do have many coastal elite listeners who also like New York Mag. New York Mag writes some good stuff, but it's just funny. It's really amusing what the perception
you use
is.
Art, which means you're arty people. You like art museums. This is the signal. And yet this guy who's writing this anonymously obviously does know something about art. He actually knows something more about art than our resident coastal elitist, Tim Miller.
Much more, right? Clearly.
Okay, so, and of course, I'm sitting here in Wisconsin reading this. Yes, that's exactly what we're doing here. I want to signal that we are down with Oprah Winfrey and Margaret Atwood.
I do think because my enjoyment of it is that, there's already this sense of, conceding that Trump is done among some of these folks, right? And I think that's interesting that the whole conceit of this article is what is going to happen to the Bulwark folks after Trump loses? And I was just, I'm like, wait, like, You guys are already moving on to a hypothetical dunk after your candidate is lost. Like, we have a couple. I want to dunk on you a little bit before you get to dunk on me, because the Bulwark, mission changes in a post Trump era. So I find that mindset that it goes into something I'm sure we'll have many, many months to talk about, Charlie. But this desire of among the kind of soft Trumpers and the conservative ink media complex to sort of memory hole the worst of the Donald Trump, and turn us into the villains.
Yeah, we're going to try to make that hard for them. But I will say this, that if we do dunk on them, we'll put our name on it, right? We won't be doing it anonymously.
Yeah. Red Elephant 9. Exactly. Really, Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Tim Miller, thanks for joining us again on the podcast and winning the 19th or 20th, the emoji that we give to people who've been on the podcast 19 or 20 times.
Charlie, we'll do it again soon. I appreciate it. Bye.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back and we will do this all over again.